Illinois. Father was a professor of ancient history at the University of Illinois. In fact, both my parents were academics, as were both of my grandfathers. Behind that, both of my great-grandfathers were ministers, one a Congregationalist and one a Methodist. I lived in Champaign through my grade school years, and then we moved to Urbana and went to junior high school in Urbana and then to high school. When I was a sophomore in high school, I came down with some sort of heart condition that nobody quite ever figured out what it was, so I was non-athletic by orders after that until I more or less graduated. Probably affected my outlook on life. I was not a jock. You have no idea what growing up being not a jock and that world was. It's probably the same today. Although nerds have a little higher standing now. They usually become millionaires. My education years, incidentally, coincided almost precisely with the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt. I started in '32 and finished in '45. That was exactly his year. So it didn't occur to me there was any other president of the United States possible. Come in. And that I was interested in public affairs, and although my first election that I was even aware of anything was the 1936 election when Alf Landon ran against Roosevelt, and I remember that only because of the sunflowers plastered everywhere. That was his.
That was his campaign.
He was from Kansas.
Uh-huh.
He carried two states. By 1940, I got very interested in the political process of the nominating conventions. Thomas Dewey was the boy wonder at that time, and was knocked off by Wendell Willkie. And Wendell Willkie turned around and became an internationalist and was helpful to Roosevelt in supporting things that needed to be done during the war. Dewey then went on to challenge Roosevelt in '44 and Truman in '48. My first vote was cast in '48 for Harry Truman. All during my childhood, I attended the Congregational Sunday School and then the youth group, which was fairly prominent in my social life. I graduated at the head of my class, and so I was, you know, a typical nerd. I was also a Boy Scout. You can put yourself back in that era. Why, in the summer of 1945, there was a war going on that looked like it would never end, or at least maybe 3 years down the road. They were building up for the invasion of the Japanese homelands and didn't anticipate any early end. So at that summer, my father was a visiting professor at Columbia University in New York, so we all lived in New York for that summer, and while I was there, I enlisted in the Navy. I was about to turn 18 in October, and if you didn't enlist in the Navy at least 30 days before your 18th birthday, you'd be drafted, and so you couldn't do it at the end. So, and I had a dear friend who was a year ahead of me who had gone to electronics school in the Navy, became a electronics technician, a radar technician in their terms those days, and I wanted to, he was sort of my role model, and I wanted to do that too. Japanese Secret Service somehow heard that I was coming and they surrendered. There was also, I was in New York when something called the atomic bomb was dropped. And I remember the headlines in the New York Times, a lot of talk. And then at that point, the Navy switched its policy and wouldn't take reserves in the Navy now that the war was over. So by the time I reported, I had to join the regular Navy, and so I had to sign up for a minority enlistment. That was from that point until I turned 21, sometimes called a kiddie cruise. And I went to electronics school and at Great Lakes, and then at Anacostia. I spent the first winter in the Great Lakes in the Great Lakes Hospital with a series of misdiagnoses, one thing and another. I got hepatitis because they gave me serum to cure my scarlet fever, which they had misdiagnosed, which was really measles. So it was warmer in bed in the winter in the Great Lakes. But then I went on to Anacostia for the secondary school, which is in just south of, it's in the District of Columbia. Which there's now a bridge there. There wasn't a bridge there in my day. You had to go all the way around. And that was my 3 years in the Navy. Was an exciting experience. I spent roughly half of it ashore and half of it aboard an aircraft carrier, a small aircraft carrier, designated CVE, escort carrier in those days. You may have come in contact with it because it was eventually sold for scrap to the Gillette Razor Company.
So we may have used it whether we know or not.
Anyway, I was the only person on the ship that knew, was supposed to know anything about radar and how to keep it working, and I was panicked, except I realized I knew more than anybody else. So that was a good learning experience. It was also a good learning experience in electronics school, in our, particularly our secondary school, where the more intense training took place. And we realized, or my brother told me, that I showed him some of the things we were studying. He said, "You're studying calculus." I said, "They never told us that." It was a special program, a 11-month program devised in that short period of time to make electronic engineers out of peasants, as it were. And it was remarkably successful, but very highly focused. And so the one experience there that was novel for me was that in our class of 30, I came in sixth, which was way down in the...
Not what you were quite used to?
Not what I was used to. I got back in stride at the University of Illinois, where in the class of 2,500, I came out number one, so that I felt So I sort of averaged those out. But anyway, in law school, just for the record, I came in 72nd in my class, which was just, I just made the cut, so I graduated with honors. It may seem strange that somebody in 72nd place in his class would graduate with honors, but we started with 550 and graduated close to 500, so, it's a respectable
definitely
showing.
Definitely in the top portion.
Yeah.
But I did not burn up the place anyway. In the Navy, when I was stationed in Washington, I continued my church relationships by going to the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church in downtown Washington, who had a famous pastor named Peter Marshall, who eventually became chaplain of the Senate, and met a family there, a girl who I eventually proposed to, who turned me down. And her father was a tax court judge in Washington, so that was my first encounter with, that's as close as I ever got to the judiciary at that point. And then when I was aboard ship, I played the organ for the chaplain. The organ was a pedal one.
I was going to say an organ on a ship.
It was a little box that you pumped with your feet. And they had the thing, you controlled the volume by spreading your legs or not, depending on. And then you had a keyboard, and it could sound sort of nice in a small enclosure. But, then when I went back to Illinois, I experienced a certain amount of culture shock. I was leaving this big anonymous Navy and going back to my hometown. And what I found was that I was leaving a ship where of 500 where I knew most of the people and stepped onto a campus of 20,000 that I didn't know a soul. So it was exactly the reverse of what I thought it would be. I thought I would be lost in the Navy, but I was lost when I came home.
Were your parents still at the university at that
time? Yeah,
point?
And I lived at home while I mm-hmm. went there. I spent 3 years as an undergraduate. I got a lot of credits for my electronics training in the Navy.
And you said the campus was 20,000?
That was in those days.
Was it mostly GIs coming back?
No,
The GIs...
The swell of them occurred while I was in the Navy because they all came back right after the war, and I was away for that period, and all my high school classmates had moved on by then. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were sort of seniors by the time I got back, so I knew some of them. I went back to my ancestral church there, and they had a college group there that I was active in all the years I was there. Had a lot of interesting experiences there. Both in high school and in college, it was a very intellectually stimulating group with, you know, a bunch of kids who are going to remake the world. Have you ever met people like that?
Oh, I think so.
Anyway, so I enrolled in the liberal arts college. My whole family, particularly my father, didn't think you were educated if you didn't have a liberal arts education. Couldn't imagine people going to the College of Commerce or Engineering or anything like that. And he wouldn't let me major in history.
Why not?
And he wouldn't let me ever take a course of his. But I majored in economics, but I had a joint minor in political science and history. And the one thing that was comforting my first semester there, when I was otherwise lost, was I was a personal friend of about half of my professors, which had its advantages. Not that they would tweak your grade upward, but because you knew them and you knew how they thought. And having grown up in an academic environment, it was much easier to do well, which, you know, that's probably the principal reason I came out on the top of my class, was that. But the other thing that both my older brother, who had come back right after the war and had finished his undergraduate and gone on to medical school, was they all had suggestions as courses I ought to take. And the only absolute prohibition was no SNAP courses. Everything had to be substantive. And the thinking was that in a substantive course, you could always earn your grade. In a SNAP course, you were thrown into a pot and there's no way you could control what grade you got. It was all pot luck.
What do you mean by a SNAP course?
The easy ones.
Oh, okay.
Where the things that people filled in their schedule with to get hours without having to work very hard.
Could you give an example of a type of class that you might consider as one?
Of course, my father felt that anything in sociology would be. But my father had this view that of what an education was, and then he was sort of downplaying the new sciences like sociology, political science, and, you know, things like that, the soft sciences, whereas, of course, people didn't get into an argument about history as a science because nobody had thought of it by then at that time. But anyway, I thoroughly enjoyed my years. I took, among other things, a course in comparative vertebrate anatomy because my brother needed that for medical school, so he thought I should take it because it was an interesting course. And it was a very rigorous course. And I was not looked on with disfavor because I took an A out of the course that some poor struggling pre-med needed to get into medical school. And they said, how can you do this to us?
Learning the curve for them.
Well, I just took away an A that would have been otherwise available. So,
were you in school with your brother at the same time?
No. He had actually graduated before the war in 42. He'd gone through, straight through, and he'd skipped a grade in grade school, so although he was 4 years older than me, he finished his undergraduate in 3 years and graduated in 42. But he needed, when he was in the army, in Japan, he saw that the only people that were well-fed were the farmers and the doctors who took care of the farmers, so he decided he didn't want to be a farmer, so he'd be a doctor. So when I was in high school, my father asked me what I wanted to be, and I suggested medicine as one possibility, and my brother preempted that, so I had to think of something else to do. And of course, neither of us were wanting to be an academic, which is ironic because my brother ended up teaching pharmacology at the University of Michigan Medical School and was associate dean of the medical school. So he ended up not only in academics but administration, another obscene word in my father's vocabulary. The other thing he didn't like was schools of education.
Did he encourage you to think about an academic career?
No.
Or did he dissuade you from it?
No. Okay. In fact, he didn't urge me to pick a career early. He said if people were urged to pick their careers early, the world would be full of firemen and policemen, which is what every grade school kid wants. But anyway, then I took the LSATs, and my last year as an undergraduate, and did very well on that. Used to get in arguments with my friends as to what it meant, what the 100th percentile is, and I explained to them that a percentile is a number of units. It goes from 0 to 100, and it doesn't mean you're at the top, it means you're in the top 1%, because then below that's the 99th percentile, so I have no idea where I was in the top 1%. But in fact, when I took the test in New York to get into the electronics program in the Navy, I knew I was going to do that, and so I got the books to study, and actually studied at the Columbia University Library. So I enjoyed doing that. And when I took the test, I got through ahead of some other people, and the guy who was administering the test checked it a little bit just to make sure it was in proper form. And he said, "Where did you go to school?" I explained I'd gone to Urbana High School, which he'd never heard of, and I was sort of curious why he asked, and he said, "Well, you can go home and tell your parents you're passed." He just glanced at him. So this is relevant mainly to, you know, how I experience the outside world is something that could be figured out intellectually, and that the, you know, I didn't need to excel at athletics because I could excel at something else. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my brother, who thought he was very bright, was a little jealous when I was valedictorian of my college class, and he wasn't. But we were friends. And he was very active in a lot of other things, big man on campus. Law school, let's see, how are we doing? Okay, law school. And I think you can probably detect at least a hint of arrogance through all this, but try to take it with kindness. After I got my LSATs back, I then decided I had to figure out where I was going to apply, what schools I should apply to get into. So I applied to Harvard, and that was all I applied to. And I was admitted to Harvard. Yeah, and
did you consider other schools, or just thought that's the one?
It didn't occur to me that, I mean, you know, it didn't enter my head that they would reject me. And which is an interesting thing, because my father panicked when he saw a letter from the dean, the admissions dean, in which he thought I'd screwed up the whole thing. And this goes back to the fact that in that generation, we were very civil rights oriented. Now, this was long before the 60s, of course, but my little group was very, I mean, there was a lot of ferment about these sorts of things. And I talked to people about, you know, in fact, we had on the campus a string of hot dog, hamburger joints called the Steak and Shake. I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but they were.
Oh, yeah.
And there were pickets on those, and they were integrated during that era. And the barber shops were integrated at that time. But in fact, my pastor got arrested for because the barber slugged him when he said they sent out a team to test, and there was a black guy student next to him, and intentionally he'd gone in behind this other guy, and so he just said, I believe this gentleman was ahead of me. And he said, "You troublemakers," and slugged him and threw him out. Which sort of helped the cause, actually. I got some publicity. And also it had ripples in our church. When the people who didn't care much for the pastor anyway and thought he was a little too socially active said, well, we should get rid of him now that he's become a common rabble-rouser.
Can you tell me, I'm less familiar about this era, and I don't sort of think about Urbana as being terribly segregated. What were some of the areas other than the barbershop that were segregated?
There was something called the North End of Town, and that's the only place where blacks were allowed to live.
Mm-hmm.
There were three blacks in my high school class. There were more, I think, in Champaign. Mm-hmm. It was a section point on the Illinois Central, and some of the people coming from the south heading for Chicago got off there and stayed.
Mm-hmm.
Housing in it was, you know, they wouldn't serve blacks at the Steak and Shake. You know, it's hard to believe this. I mean, it's just, you can't give credence to it. And, you know, it being an academic community, nobody, the concept, although not the words, of political correctness were there. But, maybe the best way to, my family was, I would say, very liberal. Although my father used to tell anti-Semitic jokes, and his colleagues would tell. And my grandfather would make reference, when we were in New York, he would talk about the black people. We ought to throw them off the cliff down to Harlem, you know, this, but jokingly, I mean, not hostily. But, so I had, you know, I couldn't put it all together. One of the favorite, one of the forms of recreation of social life in an academic world is that one professor's family would go visit the other for Sunday dinner. I mean, that was about as exciting as things got. Or maybe if it were a special occasion, Saturday night dinner or something like that. Although traditionally we had supper at night and dinner at the middle of the day. But after my brother and sister had moved on, my sister was in college part of the time I was there, but after she moved on, I was the only one there. This other professor and his wife were over, and just my parents and them and me, so there were five of us. And when I got up to, when the main course was finished, I just quietly got up and took the plates out to the kitchen and brought the dessert in. This was, you know, how we did things. It wasn't demanded, but that was the way I would be helpful. And Professor Odegaard said, he does that beautifully. And my mother put her hand on his arm and said, yes, isn't it a pity he isn't black? Now, her family had come from Baltimore, where black servants were the height of elegance. So, you know, you can't tell that joke to this generation and convey any sense of what was being said. I mean, it sounds horrible, but it was lovingly said, and it wasn't particularly. And we always had a black cleaning lady who would, you know, was, we all were, you know, it wasn't like Gone with the Wind, where Mammy was that part of the family. Mm-hmm. She was not put down at all as the inferior, but, you know, she worked for us. Mm-hmm. But anyway, this is all leading up to, I'm talking to one of my economics professors, and he said the Harvard Business School had a policy of asking the applicants not to indicate their race or to send them a picture. And so when my law school application required, didn't have any indication of race, but did say, please enclose a photograph. So I sent off my application with a little note that I was concerned about possibly participating in a program that would be racially discriminatory, and I was therefore not sending a picture. And I got this two-page letter back. His feelings were hurt that anybody would think that Harvard would do such a thing. And so he spent the first page saying there's no way we discriminate, and the second page saying, and the only reason we discriminate is to give an advantage to the black students. So he said, but we will not consider your application until you send the picture. So I wrote back, said, well, I'll go get my picture taken now. I didn't even have one to send him at that. Well, my father found his letter, and it went ballistic. He thought I was jeopardizing my future, you know, by making it, as he said, I thought somebody put you up to it. So when I get, so that's been a theme that's run through. I met when I was at law school, there was the Congregational Church had a graduate student group that I was active in, and one of the students was a graduate student at the Radcliffe Management Training Program, who graduated from Hampton Institute the year before, and her fiance was just finishing that year, so she was taking this one-year program. So I got to know her pretty well. That she was I don't know if you know Hampton Institute's a black mm-hmm. school, and she was from Pine Bluff, Arkansas, and then they were going to get married the next summer, and she invited me to the wedding, and I was the only white person at the wedding in Pine Bluff, Arkansas, before Faubus was governor, so it was the old days. Mm-hmm. A lot of strange experiences like that. But my academics at heart, I was intellectually challenged and liked it, and sort of hobnobbed with a group of Midwesterners, and, well, except for my best friend who was the son of a rabbi from Elizabeth, New Jersey, who I brought home for Christmas the first year. He was broad-minded too.
Was it a bit of a culture shock to go to school in Boston after Urbana?
Well, I'd been in Boston on my ship had come in shortly after I joined it. It came into dry dock at Charlestown Navy Yard to have a sonar dome put on the bottom of it so that it could we could engage in anti-submarine warfare. So I'd spent some time in Boston at that point, and so I hadn't seen the academic world. I guess I must have looked at the Harvard Yard and all that, but I hadn't thought at that time that was my future in any way. I was more interested in Bunker Hill and things like that. My father asked me there was one aspect of it that they answered your question. Come in.
Yeah.
Thanks very much. If I'm taking too much time on any of this.
No, this is wonderful. We'd actually like to also go back and touch on some of the things you've mentioned that we'd like to talk more about.
Well, if you want to interrupt to do it, well, you're free to, or we'll go back.
Okay.
Otherwise, I'll just keep going. I met a lot of interesting people in law school. Oh, I was telling you, my first Christmas home, my father, that was the first time I'd been home since I'd been in law school, and he said, well, what was your impression? And I said, well, I don't think they'll ever win any awards for institutional humility. Some of the professors were perfectly decent people, but the institution would never pass muster on that measure. They just think they're the greatest. And I had a friend from Indiana who used to twit the Harvard people, saying, well, we think this is a very good trade school. Just before I left, my father took me to introduce me to Dean Harno of the University of Illinois Law School, who I'd never met before. And it was essentially to apologize for my going away to law school. Dean Harno my father said, but it's time he got out of town. He said, I understand. He said, where are you going? And I said, well, I was going to Harvard. And he paused a minute and said, I've heard of that. I think it's a very good school. So it was all very genial. But I think that illustrates the difference between the two mm-hmm. schools. In those days, there was a core curriculum. So first year, I don't think you had any flexibility. You were you know, a section of 125 people. There were four sections, and so and you stayed with them for every class, although your classes moved from room to room, of course. But and you got to know other people through your dorm or maybe some other activities. And it was all pretty much all Socratic method, and everybody was terrified, and there was a you were not given the option of not reciting if you were called on. If you were dared to say unprepared, well, you got a serious raking over. And when the students eventually rose up in protest, they said one of the things they were insisting on was the no hassle pass. If he called on you, I pass, and you didn't hear any more about it. But
and were they successful in getting that?
Yeah, they humanized the school a little bit. Although the dropout rate was relatively minor because they were so impressed with the quality of their admissions program that they couldn't flunk everybody out then. But no, I was very fond of the school, actually, and the professors. I never got very close to anybody other than the one I took the seminar from in my third year.
What seminar was that?
Administrative law. I guess the reason I took it was because that seemed to be the sort of things that the New Deal was doing. You know, all these administrative agencies came in with the New Deal. And we had quite a number of cases about that, and then I realized it was a much broader topic than just that. And we were supposed to take one perspective course the first semester of our second year, and we could choose legal philosophy, legislation. I forget what some of the others were. I took Russian history, or Soviet law. They had a Soviet law expert there. They have an expert in everything. And their special man has to be either one, two, or three in the nation to be there. They insist on having, it's not possible always to get the absolute top person in the field, but you can't go any lower than third. So anyway, so they had this guy, and so between my first and second year, I went home and audited a summer school course on Russian, the language, so I could write down the case names in Russian script in the Cyrillic alphabet. That was my chief achievement from that. But anyway, then I wrote a paper, very sexy title, Intercarrier Competitive Rate Setting in the Transportation of Petroleum in the West.
That's a grabber.
Which meant I ran an awful lot of published ICC cases, the Interstate Commerce Commission, which came back to haunt me in a very interesting way later on, but if we get down to principal cases. So I was voted on my dormitory as the person least likely to crack up. Not the most likely to succeed, but the least likely to crack up.
That's something of a compliment, right?
Yeah.
Does that mean in law school?
In law school, because people do crack up in law school in those days. I don't know if they do anymore.
Probably.
There was one of my classmates just before the finals was seen roaming the halls, and asked him what he was doing, and he said he was looking for the fruit of the poison tree. He couldn't find it. I mean, that's pretty extreme.
The legal studies had just sent him around the bend.
But you know, as much as I viewed myself as a nerd, I was not a one of these people who made this fanatic sort of thing. And which meant I dropped out of competition, really, for the law review. And I was roomed next to a guy who thought I was just brilliant. You know, first place, word gets around. There was one other Illinois guy there, and he told them I'd been valedictorian. I'd never mentioned it. And somebody found out what my LSAT scores were, and that was circulated. So I was expected to do very well. In fact, my third year, when I talked to the same dean that I had the correspondence with, he said, "You know, we always wondered why you didn't do better." And I think I had part of the problem was that I had grown up and had other values. But anyway, or maybe I was just lazy. It's hard to tell. I always look at the more positive interpretation of ambiguous facts. Anyway, I was talking about my neighbor in the first year dorms. He kept saying to me, "You're going to make law review." And I said to him, "Derek, what are you going to do when the grades come out and you discover you made law review and I didn't?" And he said, "Oh, that will never happen." Well, of course, he made law review and I didn't. And one of the things he did, I mean, I thought he was sort of like me, because although he was obviously more talented, but while he was in first year, he would go down to the college and audit courses in literature down there. Archibald MacLeish was teaching a course, and he took that. I mean, he was a man. His father or his family had owned the Curtis Publishing Company in Philadelphia, which put out the Saturday Evening Post and some other things. I don't know if you ever heard his name, Derek Bach. Dean of the law school, and then went on he only lasted there a year because they made him president of the university before he was 40. Now, if you ever want something that will make you feel a failure, have one of your classmates become president of Harvard before he's 40. What have you done? And another of our classmates became head of Cravath, Swain & Moore in New York. So that there again, the successful people were the ones who didn't have the narrow view of pursuing law. This guy started at Cravath and was an associate for a couple of years, and then his father had a manufacturing plant in Indiana somewhere, and so he decided he'd go back and run the family business and work with his father. And Cravath then sent out a team of their top partners to get him to come back. They had spotted something that they had not made clear to him, but he had a great future there, and so they made him the managing partner. So those are my two most famous classmates. I don't have anybody else that became president or anything like that. Of course, they all come from Yale.
Was it generally very competitive among the students?
Most competitive place I've ever been in. That's why I just wouldn't. This guy from Indiana that I was going to tell you, I recited the first couple of times. I think I volunteered. This civil procedure professor who viewed himself as a terror would fire question. He had a very sort of staccato sort of approach and fire questions at us and look around. I raised my hand and answered. And second time I did that, this other guy who sat behind me when we were at lunch said, from the Midwest, we do not volunteer in class. So I said, oh, okay. That's what I didn't. I mean, the life was a lot pleasanter then. I think that's when I sort of made a moral values choice as to what my life would be like. And, you know, there were a lot of nice people who did very well in our class, but I don't put down the people who went the other way, but I didn't. Anyway, my last year then, the school always expects some of their people to be placed in clerkships with judges. And they, of course, would be miffed if they didn't get Supreme Court appointments. So this Dean Tepfer, backing up one step, first year we had moot court competition and we were in clubs and you just sort of picked a club and they scattered the people. I mean, if you wanted to work with somebody in particular, they people could go together in a club. And I joined the Tepfer Club. They were all named after faculty members who were our sponsors, really. And we didn't see much of our sponsors. But anyway, I just dropped that name once when I was home at Christmas that I was in the Tepfer Club in the names competition. And my father said, you know, I think you made an impression on him, but your response was, he read my response then and said, it was very temperate and well-reasoned. And but anyway, he was the one that was asked me if I wanted to be a clerk for I guess he was a Third Circuit judge out of Philadelphia, William Hasty, who was the only black Court of Appeals judge at that time, I don't know. And, you know, they, you can understand why Tepfer would think of it. And Hasty didn't take me because I had no ties to Philadelphia. He wanted somebody that might at least stay in the area and be a useful tie. So I ended up clerking on the D.C. Circuit for the chief judge there. And I wasn't his direct law clerk, but he had two motions clerks because the D.C. Circuit has an awful lot of motion work. Federal agencies are all situated there, and the appeals from administrative agencies go through the D.C. Circuit. And it's sort of a very specialized jurisdiction. They are also interesting. The state Supreme Court, as it were, for the District of Columbia court system, the municipal courts of the District of Columbia having an appellate court. But if you're dissatisfied with that, the court you go to appeal that is the D.C. Circuit, which is a strange arrangement. So I spent my, the motions would be heard. And it got to be some fairly substantive things, and I've learned a lot of that. My administrative law came in very handy at that point. And I also learned how to read statutes, you know, the difference between a statute and the law as codified. You know, the Public Act so-and-so will have a sentence. You learn your way through the numbering system, section so-and-so of the Act isn't going to have that number in the U.S. Code. It's going to, you know, carry. The Section 5 of this particular Act will amend Section 326 of the Code and substitute new language in there. So you have to be careful in your citation. It was very tricky citations. And I also discovered that high-priced lawyers don't always read the statutes. There was one case where the two sides were at loggerheads over the interpretation of the statute. One said it's this, and one said it's that. And I said, I wrote a memo to my the chief judge saying, you know, neither of them read down to the but part of the statute. And I said, they're both wrong. But then we also had a lot of petitions for leave to appeal from the district court, U.S. District Court in the D.C. Circuit, I mean, the District of Columbia, whatever the jurisdiction is there, for habeas corpus. And invariably, I suppose there may have been an appeal from a habeas corpus that wasn't from a form of corpus petitioner, you know. But most of them were handwritten and illiterate, more or less. But what you learn is that if you take the trouble to read these things, you know, they may be wrong on the law, or they may be have a misimpression about what is persuasive, but they always have something that they're bitching about. I mean, there's really something there in practically every one of them. And, you know, it isn't just something they do to pass the time in the penitentiary. They actually have something to say. And that was a hard thing to get across to the judges who heard these, because they sort of would dismiss these out of hand.
Because they would do so many?
Well, that they were... Well, most of them they denied substantively for good reason. But most of them, they didn't have any clue what the guy was saying. There was one... there would be appointed counsel sometimes. I don't know if there was always appointed. I guess there would be appointed counsel if we told them there ought to be. Mm-hmm. And appointed counsel who had been a law clerk for one of these judges, and so he thought he could, wrote a very persuasive brief and made every argument he could think of. And they were, you know, they were very strong arguments, but they never quite made it. They were losing arguments, but they were strong arguments. The only thing he didn't make an argument on was what the point the petitioner was trying to raise. You know, it's that, I mean, he made a great show, and he got lots of laudatory comments from the judges, and he was very pleased to do so, and he obviously spent a lot of time with it, and, you know, sort of served as a model. But for my money, it was the wrong model. Mm. You know, first find out what the guy's saying. And it's not that hard. It's, you know, once you figure out the handwriting. But even that, you can do it. Anyway, so I had some good experiences there. Anytime you want to stop or...
Well, would you like to take a short break now?
I need more coffee.
Yeah. Why don't we take a short break?
Okay.
And